Welcome to the South Carolina State Library's podcast, Library Voices SC. I'm Curtis Rogers, Communications Director, and today I'm pleased to have with us in our studio Dr. Heather Heckman and Amy Meany. Heather is the director of Moving Image Research Collection, and I always want to call it Film Library, but it's Moving Image Research Collections, and has a PhD in Communication Arts from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she also earned a Master of Arts degree in Library and Information Studies, as well as Communication Arts. Her publications include Burn After Viewing, and that's a great title, we might have to talk about that, or Fire in the Vaults, Nitrate Decomposition and Combustibility, and that was in the American Archivist in winter of 2010. And Amy Meany is the curator for local television news collections and science and nature films. She holds a Master of Arts degree in Public History from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and a Bachelor of Science in Cinema and Photography from Ithaca College. Her work includes curating exhibits and programs, processing collections, managing online outreach platforms, and facilitating access and use of archival moving image materials. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Glad you're here. The whole way this came about is I was listening to another podcast, and in that podcast they were talking about, it, I think it was the New England film, it was some kind of conservation. And I was like, you know, we have a really cool facility over at USC, and so I needed to get you guys in here to talk about it. So I'm glad you're here. Would one or both of you tell us a little bit about the University of South Carolina's Moving Image Research Collections and what it does, what it's all about?
Sure, yeah. So this is Heather talking. We call it MIRC for short, because Moving Image Research Collections is a bit of a mouthful. So MIRC is one of the largest film archives in the United States, certainly one of the largest affiliated with an institution of higher ed. We collect films made outside Hollywood feature filmmaking. We started with the gift of the Fox Movietone News Film Collection in 1980, but the scope of our holdings has really grown a great deal since that time. We now also collect, in addition to news film, we collect regional film. That includes home movies, science and nature film, Chinese film, and most recently we've added military film to the collecting area. The majority of the films in our collections are unique. They're held only here at USC. You can't really get access to them anywhere else. So that's a pretty neat thing.
It really is, and I went to your website, and you have a great intro video that explains everything, so we'll have links on our podcast page to your website. But one of the things that really intrigued me was being able to go and look at some of these films in the digital collections, because I think you partner, is it with South Carolina Digital Library that those get uploaded to, or?
It's a little complicated. It's more complicated than it should be. So yes, we do have some materials in South Carolina Digital Library. We have even more online in MIRC's own, we call it the Digital Video Repository. Our staff call it the DVR, although that's confusing because it means something different to most people.
Not digital video recording.
No, yeah. So the Digital Video Repository is MIRC, M-I-R-C, so Moving Image Research Collections, MIRC.SC.EDU. And there are nearly 10,000 videos in there that you can watch anytime for free.
Wow, that's amazing. And I just looked at a quick list, and there was one on, Arts and Crafts. It was some kind of folk art, and that was a 20-minute video. You know, and it's just a lot of stuff that you can get in there. Do you ever put any of the archived videos onto YouTube?
No, not really. In some cases, yes, but it's rare.
Okay. Because that would, because I'm like you, it was like a few things were a little bit complicated to try to find.
And it's true.
We're working on that.
That happens. Tell us a little bit about, Amy, the science and nature films, because that's part of what you do.
Yes. So science and nature films is mostly comprised of two rather large collections. The largest one is the Roman Vishniac Film Collection. Roman Vishniac is primarily known for being a photographer. He is well known for photographing Jewish communities in Eastern Europe prior to World War II, but When he came here in the 1940s, he went back to doing something he had been doing since he was a child, which was filming and photographing microscopic organisms through microscopes. So this collection is cinemicroscopy, and we've got some still images, so photomicroscopy as well.
I have just learned two new words.
Yeah, and I mean, we have pictures of him from the collection of literally him pointing his camera directly through the lens of a microscope.
Wow.
And so he worked with the National Science Foundation in the 1960s and 70s to put together a series called Living Biology. He had made a few before that as well. But so they were primarily what we have is outtake footage and raw camera material from what he was filming to go into those films. And so it's a lot of just the camera original, totally out of context, totally beautiful aesthetic images. They're mm-hmm. really, the color is vibrant and they're really kind of glorious looking. And then we also have some prints of the films that he actually managed to put together with them. Mm-hmm. But it's primarily the raw camera footage, which is really beautiful.
That's amazing. And there is such a difference. I noticed you have your degrees in photography, and that's always been a hobby of mine. And there's such a difference in film versus digital. You know, you mm-hmm. can still see a big difference. It's not that one is, you know, better than the other because they both have their positive qualities, but you can really tell a difference. It's really interesting. So if each of you would just talk a little bit about maybe how you got interested in doing this kind of work, because it's very specialized in the library world.
Yeah. So when I was an undergraduate, I was studying film studies, also French, but film studies at Wesleyan University. And I didn't even know this was a job you could go into. I mean, I had no idea. Mm-hmm. I went right into grad school. So my degree is in communication arts, but really was a film studies program. And I realized pretty quickly that I didn't want to be an academic. But I was really fortunate. My grad school had a great archive associated with it. Actually, my undergrad institution also had an archive associated with it, so there's not a great excuse for me not understanding this was a career. But the grad school's archive, the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research, I was really fortunate to be able to volunteer there and ultimately work there. I cut my teeth there. I just fell in love with this profession, and I ended up going to library school as well.
So for me, as an undergrad, when I was working, I was working with 16-millimeter film and traditional still photographic processes, and I just really fell in love with film as a physical format and medium, like you were saying. I mean, that difference between film and digital, there's mm-hmm. something about, you know, holding a strip of film in your hands and watching, you know, just looking mm-hmm. at these individual photographs mm-hmm. and knowing that they come to life through a projector, that it's tactile and tangible and just really, really beautiful. And so I just sort of started waxing poetic and philosophical about the beauty of film. But so I really fell in love with the actual physicality of it. And in grad school, I was focused on collections management and interpretation. I was also working in the archives and special collections at the university and was interning in the photographic history department at the Smithsonian. So I was getting experience in specifically in archives and museums as well. And so this sort of combination just left me with this particular interest and love of preserving this particular medium. But also it's sort of Second Life as both kind of a document and an artifact mm-hmm. and, you know, preserving the physicality, the object itself, but also the ways people interact with it and the way that it's captured and influenced our history in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. It's really, really important. And, you know, that's one of the reasons for concentrating on in this episode of our podcast, because this is Library Voices SC, and we tend to have a lot of authors or, you know, writers come and talk about their work or things that kind of relate to libraries. But every once in a while, it's nice to talk to, you know, real librarians. So one of the things that, Heather, you mentioned mm-hmm. Is home movies. Mm-hmm. How do you determine what is like worthy, you know, I mean, because you think of, well, here's a home movie of, you know, from the 1950s of maybe someone's child in a blow up swimming pool. And you think, how is that, you know, why would we keep that?
Yeah, so we get that question a lot. And certainly there's a spectrum, right? So many home movies are poorly exposed, maybe not even in focus, shaky, quite unpleasant to watch. You don't even see a lot. There's not a lot recorded to see. On the other hand, you know, home movies are, well, sort of the canonical example everyone comes up with is the Zapruder film, right? I mean, there are cases where undeniably home movies have been our only moving image record of really important events.
Mm-hmm.
And in between that, there's a whole body of documentation of everyday life, just quotidian life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's an art, not a science. There's mm-hmm. not... there's not like a hard and fast way of going mm-hmm. about this. But and moreover, one kind of challenging thing about film is it's a bit hard to know what you have until you kind of already have it to take a look.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, once we figured out what a home movie is, we've sort of already done the hard part of processing, mm-hmm. if that makes mm-hmm. sense. But we're looking for content that documents daily life. We are certainly interested in things that are kind of right down home plate for home movies. So yeah, we really do want your home movies of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
100 years from now, people won't know what Christmas in 1950 looked like. It won't seem so
exactly.
Banal.
And if someone is doing research on, you know, the daily life of
right.
what was happening, then that fits in perfectly with what they're trying to find out, because there are nuances
mm-hmm.
that you can take away from film that you maybe can't take away from still photography.
And it's interesting to see how things, traditions like those, change over time. If you have a kind of a corpus or a body of materials, you can see the difference between Christmas as celebrated in 1956 and even 1976, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At the same time, home movies were an expensive habit for most of
right.
the 20th century. Just the fact of being able to make home movies for many families, at least through the mid part of the century, means that you were probably middle class or
mm-hmm.
wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
That means you were probably white.
Mm-hmm.
So we also privilege collections that come to us that might document minority groups or family structures that don't show up as commonly. And then finally, we really like to get footage of our state. The reality is that many of our home movie collections do not depict South Carolina.
Because people went on vacation. And they
people went on vacation, that's right, that's right. And also because people retired to South Carolina. And
uh-huh.
maybe when they were shooting home movies, they actually weren't living here. Right,
right. Right.
And we have some great materials shot in other states and abroad. There's a really lovely collection from the Northeast that includes footage of speakeasies from the
wow.
Prohibition era. We just had preserved with federal funding a collection that shows in color Berlin in the 1930s.
Wow.
These are great, great materials, and we are so thrilled to have them. But we also are interested in documenting South Carolina. So
mm-hmm.
so that content also gets kind of a higher collecting priority.
Right. You mentioned, you know, the archiving and the preservation aspect. And I remember years ago I had been on a tour of your facility, and it's amazing, and it's huge. You go in, and you really need like two or three sweaters, because you have to keep it, you know, so you have to keep a certain temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that process and how you make sure that everything stays okay.
Yeah, so film is plastic. Video, for most of the 20th century, also plastic. Most people think of plastic as forever. In fact, it's not. Especially cellulose acetate, cellulose nitrate, the plastics that were used for the film industry for basically all the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
they're very large molecules, and they kind of naturally want to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't want to alarm you. It's also all things, especially compared to like subsequent video carriers, very stable.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, if you keep it too hot, if you introduce it to too much humidity, both things that kind of typify the climate down here, right? I moved here from Wisconsin, and I could not in Wisconsin, home movie collections always look great.
Yeah, right.
And it took me like months to understand why home movies look terrible here. It should have been obvious.
Yeah,
but
just the weather.
Yeah, exactly. But so like any, it's just like high school science, right? Like any reaction, the colder it is, the slower it goes. Mm-hmm. And then we also want to keep things dry because water catalyzes the reaction that breaks down these plastics. So yeah, we just try to keep them cold and dry, and we call that passive preservation, just put them in a good environment. And it's remarkably effective. In one of our vaults, we're quite confident that cellulose acetate materials will last hundreds of years. So,
and I remember seeing somewhere that under the really wrong conditions, some of them can spontaneously combust, or...
You're thinking of nitrate, yes.
Nitrate, okay.
So we do have a very large nitrate collection. That's something that separates us from a lot of peer film archives in the United States. Most of that, well, all of our nitrate is stored at Fort Jackson in World War II munitions bunkers.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
For the exact reason that you mentioned.
Right, yeah. How do you get access? Do you have to go through all the...
Well, so if a user wants access to that material, they would simply need to let us know beforehand. Most of the time, what we would typically do is make a digital copy for them.
Okay.
So with some, you know, several days' notice, we would bring it back from the fort, make a copy. Or sometimes we already have a copy available. But if our staff needs access, yeah, we need to have Department of Defense IDs, and we need to get onto base and pick it up. We have our archivist goes out to Fort Jackson really every day that he works.
Wow.
Brings some stuff back to Merck and takes some stuff back to the vaults.
That's a really interesting partnership. Do any other moving image collections have that kind of partnership in their locations?
It used to be a very typical way of managing that risk. To my knowledge, we are the only archive that still maintains that kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it just has to do with the fact that a lot of bases closed. I mean, there are fewer bases in the U.S. now than there used to be. So fewer states have the opportunity to do something like what
we do. Right, just because of lack of resources. Tell us about some other special collections. I know, Amy, you had mentioned the one collection that has the, what is it called again?
The Roman Vishniak?
Yeah, that was a name I just couldn't remember off the tip of my tongue. But what are some of the other special collections that you guys have?
So the largest collecting area that I work in is the local TV news collections, which is close to 2 million feet of 16-millimeter film footage, and those are from three South Carolina stations. So that's footage from WIS, WLTX, and WBTW. This film dates from about the early 1960s to about 1980, and it's outtake material. So this isn't the full broadcast that was on people's screens at homes because the stations weren't recording those. So this is the 16-millimeter film footage that reporters and cameramen would go out and capture out in the world, and then it would be brought back into the studio and possibly used in addition to the broadcast, you know.
B-roll.
Yeah, so the time and place of this footage being in South Carolina in the 1960s, and particularly with WLTX and WIS being based in Columbia, first of all, there's a really nice geographic coverage of a lot of the state, but also because of the time period, that means that we have footage of, I mean, local politics and politicians, but also things, a lot of material related to the civil rights movement and activism in South Carolina, particularly on a local level, but also, you know, more nationally known people kind of coming in and participating as well. A lot of things related to kind of local community matters, development of the city, things related to the you know, local universities, including USC, Benedict, Allen, SC State, Voorhees. There's material related to all of those as well. So there's a lot of different footage, and it's nice because it was primarily stuff that was actually shot out in the world. There's a lot of documentation of people and places, and not just the studio, because they were out at the State House. They were out, you know, just sort of anywhere, so we can kind of see a particular place in a particular time, and mm-hmm. so it's documenting whatever event they're covering, but also everything that's in the background as well. So mm-hmm. it's really nicely representative of the area. A subset of the WIS collection is the Awareness Collection, which is outtake footage from the 1970s of Awareness, which was started in 1970 as an African American public affairs program, which was the first of its kind in South Carolina, and has been on the air since 1970. And another part, WIS is the largest collection that we have of the local TV. And so another portion of that, which is unique to the WIS collection, is broadcast scripts. So even though we don't have recordings of the actual broadcasts, we have the paper materials that were what the anchors would be reading on a given day. And those date from, it's kind of spotty in the early 1960s, but then into the later 1960s and then into the 1970s, we've got scripts for just about every day. And those are really nice because they're, first of all, the closest that we can come to recreating an entire segment, but also there are cues on there for when they would cut to a piece of film footage that we often have. There's additional context, there's additional names, information, so it's really useful for me when I'm processing, but also just as a research tool for anyone else. I mean, mm-hmm. looking at how not just the events that were happening, but also local coverage of national events, particularly because the film that was shot primarily in South Carolina, so the coverage of national events is coming through in the scripts, mm-hmm. Because there's rarely film footage for that specifically. Right. So it's really just kind of, they're really, really helpful in putting together sort of a larger picture of the scope and coverage of the film footage.
Mm-hmm. What do you find is your most heavily used collection?
Fox Movie Tone News.
The Fox Movie Tone News.
It's our largest collection. It's our most heavily used collection. And it is used to an extent. It's not simply the most used because it's the largest, if that makes sense. It's mm-hmm. it's used proportionally even more than one would predict just on size alone.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that always pops into my mind is copyright. Mm-hmm. If someone wanted to come, say they're working on a documentary, mm-hmm. what do they have to know about copyright to be able to reproduce any of the stuff that you have digitized?
Great question. So that's going to vary collection by collection. But by and large, one of the things that we have been very lucky in is that, so for example, when Fox Movie Tone was donated, that was our first major collection, it came with copyright. So they gave us not just the content, not just the physical material, mm-hmm. but also the rights to the content.
Wow.
And that set a precedent, I think, for Merck that made, I think, the university quite aggressive in pursuing rights for other collections that came as well. It's not going to be true across the board. Mm-hmm. Our most recent, sort of the largest quantity of materials that have come in through the door of scale recently would be the United States Marine Corps Film Repository. Mm. That's not a donation, that's a partnership. Mm. Now, the overwhelming majority of the materials in that repository are going to be public domain. They're produced by the Marine Corps mm-hmm. for the yep. American people, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not a situation where we own the rights. The mm-hmm. Chinese film collection is another one. Copyright can be a bit murky mm-hmm. when you start to get into international trade, and particularly when you start getting into a national trade between the United mm-hmm. States and China. Mm-hmm. And then our smaller collections, again, it's going to vary a little bit collection by collection. But we have been fortunate to have large portions of our holdings come with the rights as part of the original gift. And that means that if you are a filmmaker and you want to come reuse some of our content in an original work that you are making, we are happy to work with you. In fact, we work with filmmakers all the time. They're one of our primary user groups. But we are going to charge you for that privilege. The fees are negotiated on a case-by-case basis. And any revenue we bring in from licensing is going to go back to the collections. It's going to support preservation. It's going to support access. It's going to make sure that these films are still available for other people to see, around the world now and into the future.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're talking about stuff like this, yes, there need to be fees. This is a very expensive I would imagine, very expensive undertaking for the university to have. So,
yes, yes, the Dean of Libraries loves to tease that we are probably the most expensive special collections unit. Now,
I would imagine it definitely is one of the most expensive, because, you know, if you look at the facility, what it takes to maintain that facility, and, you know, it's the thousands and thousands of films that you have.
You know, I mean, there are all kinds of mixed materials and all kinds of collections, but at the average, you may be right. I mean, media tends to be relatively expensive to care for. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned that you had filmmakers as a typical library patron. What or who are some of the other folks who need to use your services?
Yeah, great question. So we are open to the public. I want to be very clear about that, although we do encourage you to make an appointment. Most of our work is actually done remotely. We typically will provide you, because we have the luxury of copyright for most of our content, mm-hmm. most of the time we'll provide you with a copy you can watch at home.
Mm-hmm. It's not just like going into a library and getting a book off a shelf. It's
no,
a completely
yeah.
different process.
If you walk into our building cold, it's likely that we will just end up creating an appointment for something mm-hmm, down mm-hmm. the line. Mm-hmm. So we are open to the public, but it behooves you to make an appointment.
Plan ahead.
Plan ahead, yep. But that means that we are also open to users of all kinds, all affiliations. Of course, we work regularly with the students and faculty at the University of South Carolina. We also work with researchers at other higher ed institutions. Filmmakers are among our most frequent users. We also send content to other museums, in some cases libraries, locally and, well, really around the world. Mm-hmm. And we work with just members of the public. Sometimes folks have hobbies or passions about anything, really. I don't know, vehicles mm-hmm. of the past, fashions of the past. Or we'll work with people who have reason to believe that a family member was in a Fox Movie Tone newsreel.
Okay.
And that's always really rewarding when we're able to to find something for them to see. Amy, what would you add?
I often end up working with people in the university and also local institutions. So if I'm sort of filling research requests or curating something, I often end up working with the Nickelodeon Theater, mm-hmm. Historic Columbia, Columbia SC63. There's a lot of local organizations, particularly for the collection that I care for, because mm-hmm. it's local TV news
right.
and there's so much locally based footage that there's, you know, often institutions or people who are doing research or using the materials for that I'll end up working with.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned working with or serving other libraries. I can't imagine through interlibrary loan how you, you know, do you loan a film? Do you digitize it first? Or how do you work with other libraries?
It really depends on the context, but we typically would not loan a film. Now, one counterexample there would be if we're working with another film archive that might have what we call exhibition mm-hmm. Attached, so they might have a theater where they show film. Mm-hmm. In those cases, we might loan a print. But more commonly, we might send a DVD or even just a link to something online. Other times, so libraries can also have exhibit space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we might send something that they would project for a short period of time or for
okay.
a longer period of time. Amy, what would you add to that discussion?
I think there's different ways that people can access things, but usually it's sending some sort of a copy
mm-hmm.
and not the original element itself.
Yep.
And to clarify, when we do send actual film to be projected, it typically is also a copy. It's usually a preservation copy.
Okay.
But it's a copy that's made on film rather than a digital derivative.
Yeah. One of the things I forgot to ask is, what kind of amount of time are we talking about when you receive an actual film, physical film?
Yeah.
The start to finish of, you know, looking at it, analyzing it, making sure it's what kind of shape it's in,
right.
and then actually digitizing it.
Yeah, so one way that film archives are expensive is we need a lot of climate-controlled storage, and that can add up over the long term, even in the short term, right? Another way that we're expensive is in making copies. Mm-hmm. But I guess, and this is a bit the same conversation, but, you know, it's also very labor-intensive mm-hmm. to have the kind of materials that we have. I might ask Amy to talk a little bit about what she does when a new collection comes in.
Sure. It's... As much of what we've said so far, it's going to depend on the circumstances of what's literally coming into us. So mm-hmm. how large the collection is, the physical condition, the amount of documentation that it's coming in for, the amount of documentation that it probably requires to be able to share with the public. Because of the nature of the collections that I have, I don't usually bring in new collections. Mm-hmm. Before I moved over, I was working with home movie collections as they came in as well. But the size of the collections that we have means that the entirety of the collections that I work with still aren't completely processed. So I mm-hmm. still do go through this process regularly. But so it's going to depend on, A, the state of the film when it came in. You know, was it in an attic in South Carolina for 50 years?
Right.
Or was it in a reasonably climate-controlled room? So we'll go through generally, and again, it'll depend, but there's sort of a triage step that's sort of, okay, what kind of care, what level of care does this piece of film need right now? We go through and we inspect it. We can repair mechanical damage. We rehouse it into something that's acid-free. To really just look at the state of the material itself and then try to take in information as far as content and, you know, notes on whatever, you know, the can that it came in, the box that it came in on, the leader, any of the edge codes on the film itself. We'll try to note that down.
So I'm going to interrupt Amy here for a second. So one thing to know is we've said several times that most raw footage is unique. It's typically raw, unedited, camera original footage,
okay.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's coming in the door is not His Girl Friday. It's not like a known...
not a finished product.
Not a finished product. It's not a known entity. Most of the time, more often than not, let's put it that way, the notes on the can about what you have are right. But that still means maybe 40% of the time it's completely divorced from what you actually get.
Yeah.
There's a lot of just human intervention to figure out what we have
mm-hmm.
And to then make that findable for other people.
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite at the place yet where it can be automated, where as part of digitization, description is going to happen just on the fly by
mm-hmm.
your computer.
Mm-hmm.
They tell me it's coming, but for now, it's still actual people
mm-hmm.
Looking at the film on inspection tables, watching the digitized files, writing out what they
mm-hmm.
see.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have, if any librarians are listening, you know, it's rare that we can do copy cataloging.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't very many ways for us to really economize on labor.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, sorry, Amy, back over to you.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, especially because usually even if the notes on the can are correct,
mm-hmm.
they are often just, you know, for a case of a home movie, Christmas 1943, in the cases of when we're really, really lucky and a family brings in, you know, the names of all the people involved and every place they went to and, you know, like broken down shot lists, that's glorious. We love
mm-hmm.
those people.
Mm-hmm.
But more often than not, the materials that we're dealing with, even if they are labeled correctly,
mm-hmm.
that label is often limited.
Mm.
They're not coming in with like a pre-written description as far as what the content is coming in as or what it was. So
mm-hmm.
looking at all of that material ourselves, doing a little bit, often there's, you know, a layer of research trying to verify, is this what it says it is? And then
mm-hmm.
what does that mean beyond that?
Right.
You know, even if for the local TV collections, when they came in with some documentation and it's still saying, you know, McNair State House and a date,
mm-hmm.
I know that he's, you know, he's speaking somewhere, but I don't
mm-hmm.
necessarily know what the content of that was.
Right.
So if I, you know, if I want to give that description a little bit more information, I'll go digging to find out, you know,
mm-hmm.
in digitized newspapers, which are just one of my favorite things. They're so, so helpful.
Especially if you've got a date, a good firm
yes.
date associated
yeah.
with an activity that someone has filmed, and you can go and do even better research.
Mm-hmm. It's really, really helpful. So just to get a little bit more on, especially because some of the footage is a lot of the footage is silent. Mm-hmm. That's definitely true in the case of home movies. Most of it is silent. Mm-hmm. For TV news, some of it is and some of it isn't. For Fox, a lot of it is. So it's really, really helpful to be able to have some additional information when we can't just, we can watch it and see what's happening, but we can't necessarily mm-hmm. watch it and hear what's being spoken about. Mm-hmm. So an additional layer of research is often included. But again, it's going to kind of depend on, you know, there's always more to do and only so much time and, mm-hmm. and money to do it in. So like I said, with that triage, it's sort of like what, you know, we often try to look at what's minimum viable, right? Mm-hmm. So what mm-hmm. can we do to keep this safe and preserved and get it out to people as quickly as possible?
But in a way that they can probably find it.
Yeah. 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 And then knowing like we are here to help you find it if we, you know.
Right.
If we haven't.
That's what I always say. Just call us. You know, yeah. Talk to someone. We're glad to help you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned about the triage when you get in a piece of film, you must have some really specialized equipment that you have to use, and probably some of it might have to be old equipment that you can actually still, you know, watch the film. But then, of course, you've got updated, specialized, really high-tech equipment for digitization. So what's your equipment like?
Yeah, so another thing that kind of separates media collections from quote-unquote more material, more traditional collections, I don't, paper-based, I guess, is they were designed from the beginning to be used with elaborate technologies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A projector is actually, like a film projector is actually pretty simple compared mm-hmm. to some other stuff that
I was used to. I was used to be the volunteer in third grade to, you know, to film, put the film through the.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, projectors also sort of inevitably damage film. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. like a sad fact of that whole industry that the very thing that you needed to watch the movie also yeah. gradually destroyed it.
Yeah. Scale, and it's kind of shockingly violent, essentially.
Right, especially it's bad when you're watching it and all of a sudden you see it start to melt
oh,
on
yeah,
the screen.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Because they're hot, right? Right. And they have little teeth that they use to pull the film mm-hmm, through. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but so, yeah, so you're right, a spectrum of things. So on the one hand, it can be as simple as what we call hand rewinds. Mm-hmm. So these are just cranks mounted on a table, mm-hmm. And you turn the handle and mm-hmm. it rolls the film from one reel to the other reel, and someone's just looking at it by eye. Mm-hmm. This teeny tiny image by eye with like a loop for magnification. Then we have things like a Steinbeck, which was an editing machine used during the 20th century, where you would run your film on a table and it would show you, just with a system of mirrors, an image. A lot of them have sound heads as well, as you can hear the sound. More gentle than a projector, mm-hmm. But it still has teeth. Film shrinks. It can get smaller with age. So a Steinbeck can also damage film. Also, it's an aging technology. The Steinbecks mm-hmm. themselves need a lot of love and care. And then you start to get into, I'm brushing past a lot of things.
Oh,
here.
Sure,
for the geeks listening who actually care. But then you start to get into modern day scanners. Prices are coming down, but historically mm-hmm. they've been pretty expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, scanning can be time intensive too. I think people just sort of imagine, well, you have the scanner, problem solved, right? But in fact, you need to physically prepare a film before you can put it up on a scanner, so that first of all, you can be sure that the scanner doesn't damage the film. And mm-hmm. scanners are, by and large, again, more gentle than the other generations of things I've spoken about, but mm-hmm. still, dependent on the model, dependent on the film, there's a possibility for damage.
Sure.
And you want to make sure that your film is in a good condition to get a good image on the scanner. Scanning usually is not going to go much faster than projection speed, which is, for sound film, 24 frames a second. Sometimes it's slower, yeah. mm-hmm. so that it can get a good exposure. You need to do some corrections to what comes off the scanner mm-hmm. after the scanning is done. And you're making very large files, and mm-hmm. storing files is an expense, right?
Yes,
so digital, the digital frontier is not a low-cost frontier for libraries, and that's true of us as just as much as it is for our colleagues working with article databases, right? In some ways more so, because one single film takes up a lot of space. We have tried to estimate how much space the Fox Movietone collection would take up if we digitized it. We think it would be about 5 petabytes for a single copy.
Well, now, for those who don't know, what is a petabyte?
Yeah, I thought that might be a follow-up question.
I've heard of terabyte.
Yeah, so I'm gonna assume that most listeners know what a terabyte is. It's 1,000 gigabytes.
Okay.
And a petabyte would be 1,000 terabytes.
So it's really, really big.
It's large. You know, I mean, it's a rapidly changing world. A few years ago when I said a petabyte, people's eyes would bug out.
Right.
But I'm reaching the point where, although the university does not have that kind of capacity at the moment, it's not a scale that seems impossible for a university. And
sure.
You know, I mean, the data world is growing fast. But
yes.
Yeah, so we have a large storage footprint, potentially. I also like to tell my friends in IT, saying that the Fox Movietone collection at preservation quality, scanned at preservation quality, would be 5 petabytes means that we already have 5 petabytes of data sitting,
wow.
Sitting. It's just that it's stored on film instead of on servers.
It's amazing when you think of that translation from analog to digital.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's crazy. So as we kind of wrap up,
excuse me, sorry.
What other kinds of special projects do you have coming up?
So some of your listeners might already have heard about our project to digitize the films of the United States Marine Corps. You can learn more about that project at library.sc.edu/Marine Corps. I encourage you to go check it out. We are in a push to digitize the film materials that were held at Marine Corps University in Quantico. It is the focus of USC Libraries for Give for Garnet, which is USC's Day of Giving on April 18th. So we would love your support. And even if you are unable to support us financially, you can learn more about the project, again, at library.sc.edu/Marine Corps. But we've got a lot of other stuff going on as well. Amy, do you want to talk about some of the things you're working on?
Sure. So recently, I curated a program of TV news footage for a screening at the Nickelodeon for the 50th anniversary of the Orangeburg Massacre. I also, I believe last month, presented a program at the Deckle Edge Literary Festival at the Richmond Library on the Awareness Collection. So those are just kind of examples of some of the curatorial projects that I'm often working on, and those sort of are common and kind of rolling, and honestly kind of one of my favorite parts of the job, because it's an opportunity to share our materials.
Sure.
So those sorts of things are sort of often usually in the works. And for instance, I'm really interested in finding an outlet for a program that really highlights the women in the local TV collections, particularly the women activists during the civil rights movement. So that's something I'm working on. I'm also currently looking for grant funding opportunities to digitize the WIS broadcast scripts to get them added online and be text searchable, so that they're, you know, a resource to me, but also to anyone else then who could access them. So I'm excited about that opportunity. And then just, you know, the day-to-day, continuing to process the unprocessed parts of the collections.
Well, you both have your work cut out for you. A lot of stuff going on. So thank you both so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
And thank you to our listeners. You can find Library Voices SC on Podbean, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio, or add us on your favorite podcast app. Our podcast website address is librarycast.podbean.com. We love hearing from our listeners, so send us your comments and suggestions for future topics. Library Voices SC is the official podcast of the South Carolina State Library. Until next time, this is Curtis Rogers. Thanks for listening.